Thank you, Iris. Good morning, everyone. It is so good to be with you. As you may know, we've recently been working our way through the prayer that Jesus taught us to pray. And today, we're focusing on the part of the prayer where Jesus says to say, "Give us this day our daily bread." I know we just prayed that prayer, but I want to read it one more time because I want us to focus a little bit on a couple of spots in the prayer, a couple of verses. "This then is how you should pray. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come. Your will be done." Remember this part, "your will be done. On earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread." That's the part we're going to talk about. "And forgive us our debts, as we have also forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one." All right, so let's keep those two things in mind, praying for God's will to be done, and then praying for our daily bread. Speaking of bread, I grew up in Beirut in Lebanon, and we eat lots of bread in the Middle East. It hasn't changed a whole lot. We eat bread with everything. We eat bread with cheese, we eat bread with eggs, we eat bread with olives, we eat bread with shawarma, we eat bread with shish kebab, and so on and so forth. We eat bread at breakfast, we eat bread at lunch, and we eat bread at dinner. Now, the idea of bread in the Bible is not just about eating bread. The idea of bread in the Bible encompasses all of that we eat in a given day. Really, it's all of our sustenance, all of that we need in a given time. It's kind of like in English saying, bringing home the bacon. It doesn't mean that you're going to eat bacon for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, it just means that you're going to bring a salary that takes care of all of your needs. And that's really the idea here. But notice that it's asking God for the basics. It's not asking for luxuries. It's not asking for cheesecake. It's not asking for cookies. It's not asking for baklava. It's talking about asking for the basics of what we need for the day. That word "daily" is actually really interesting in the original Greek because it's the only time in the New Testament where that word is used. Not only that, in all the other Greek documents of that era, we don't have another use of that term. So we have to kind of rely on how this term was interpreted by the people who read it at the time. And there are three possible interpretations that turn out. They're very close, but I want to kind of talk about each one so you can kind of see where this is going. When I was growing up, I used to pray this prayer in Arabic. And in Arabic, the translation that it comes from says, "Lord, give us enough bread for today." So that's slightly different, right? But it's still kind of the same idea. Another nuance is that we are asking for tomorrow's bread today. That's the second possible interpretation. And this actually fits with the culture at the time, because a daily laborer at the time would work, and at the end of the day, they would get their payment in, you know, the coins of the time, and that would be usually just enough to buy food for the next day. And so it kind of fits, give us tomorrow's bread today. Yet a third way to understand the original Greek is that Jesus is saying to ask God for our daily bread on an ongoing basis. And this fits a little bit more with our society today. Most people get paid every 2 weeks. And so the idea that we are asking God to continue to give us what we need to survive on a regular basis, that fits more easily with our culture today. Now, I don't think it is just asking for money. I don't think it's just asking for the ability to pay our bills. I think it really does mean all of our needs, physical, emotional, spiritual. So whether it's help with a difficult customer at work, or help raising our kids, or help with a relationship, whatever it is that is current, whatever it is that is on our mind for the moment, I think that is appropriate, and we are being invited to bring those particular needs, what's on our mind for today, to God. We tell him how we feel about it, and then we ask him for what we need for that day. Now, whichever one of these three interpretations ends up being closer to what people, what Jesus intended at the time, I think the bottom line of what Jesus intended is really still the same. He wants us to know that he's the one that provides what we need. And he wants us to ask him actively for what we need. And that even though we have jobs and we have businesses and we have income, he is still the one that provides that income. And he is still the one that provides what we need. And by asking him for it actively every day, we remind ourselves. And it brings that knowledge deeper. But not only that, it brings that experience deeper. We experience asking him and seeing him give us what we need. Now, you know that earlier in the prayer, I said to notice that we need to ask for God's will to be done. Jesus said that. He said, ask God's will to be done. And I was always a little bit confused. Why is he saying, ask for God's will to be done? And then he tells us to ask for a bunch of other things. Aren't all these other things included in God's will being done? Wouldn't it just be, you know, a little bit more efficient to just say God's will be done and trust him to take care of all the details? Well, one reason that we don't just do the summary prayer, Lord, let your will be done and be done with it, is because Jesus said to do it this way. Jesus said to do it a little differently. Jesus said to do it in summary and then to go into the detail. And so it's up to us to obey and do it in summary and then do all the details. But I don't know about you, most of us when we were kids at some point annoyed our parents with why, and exasperated them to the point where they said, because I say so. And how many of us said that as parents we would not do that? And of course we did that many times. There are times, however, where it's pretty clear why God wants us to do something. And I think actually this one is pretty clear. At least it has become clear to me over the years. Over the years, I have learned that the process of asking God for what I need is invaluable to shaping my relationship with him. Let me say it again. The process of asking God for what we need is invaluable to shaping our relationship with him. Now, the main area for me where I've had to go to him day after day, year after year, asking him for what I need daily is in dealing with anxiety. Anxiety has been in my family for the last three generations, at least. My grandmother lived in Antioch. Yeah, it's the same Antioch that's in the New Testament. And she lived in a time before antibiotics. She lived in a time of epidemics. And she lived in a time that was not easy on her family. She had 13 children, and she lost 8 of them to illness and disease. And you can imagine that was very traumatic and it affected her deeply. One of the ways it affected her is that it caused her to have an anxiety disorder around illness. Whenever one of her surviving children would get sick, she would get very anxious. My mother, growing up in that environment, internalized that anxiety. And when we were growing up, my siblings and I, if one of us got sick, my mom would get very anxious. And so watching this growing up, I internalized it as well. I didn't know. It was very subconscious. But when my kids were born is the first time I realized they had an anxiety disorder. Because if they sneezed, I was sure they were getting bronchitis. If they coughed, I was sure they were getting pneumonia. And, you know, if it wasn't for my wife, I would have been a frequent flyer to the ER. Now, the result of all this anxiety is that it drove me into the arms of Jesus. It intensified my prayer life. It caused me to try different ways to pray. And over time, I began to notice that some forms of prayer were actually more helpful for anxiety than others. And then later, when God called me to be a psychotherapist, I started to see why. You know, there were certain forms of treatment for anxiety that were actually really similar to the more effective ways that God had taught me to pray. And then later, when God called me to go back and study spiritual formation, I learned even more ways to pray that were helpful for anxiety. A few years ago, as Iris just said, I wrote a book. God called me to write about the very things that he had taught me. So I tried to bring together in the book what I had learned in my own prayer life, what I had learned through spiritual formation, what I had learned through psychotherapy and brain science, and to kind of bring it together. And the way I organized it in the book is just like she said, the first two parts. The first one part is, how do you pray for anxiety in the moment? You know, when we're anxious, there's a way to pray. But then praying through past hurts that caused anxiety today, that's a different kind of prayer. And so that's the second part of the book. And then the third part of the book is about how do we pray to build resilience in the face of anxiety in the future? How do we learn to trust God? And that's what we're talking about today. Now, if you want to hear about the first two parts, come to the workshop at 1 o'clock. So let's talk a little bit about learning to trust God and what that has to do with asking Him for our daily bread. First, I have a question for you. How many of you have had a time when you were anxious and someone was trying to be really helpful and they told you that you needed to trust God? Has that ever happened to any of you? So second question, was that helpful? Not usually, right? For some people, it does work. But for many people who struggle with anxiety, including me, it did not work. I heard that a lot, and it didn't work a lot. I remember one of the best books on the topic I read was written by a guy called Jerry Bridges, a famous author from a ministry to college students called The Navigators. He wrote a book called Trusting God When Life Doesn't Make Sense. And the book made an excellent case for trusting God. Jerry Bridges said, we can trust God because A, He loves us, B, He's all-powerful, and C, He's all-wise. Very difficult to argue with. It's an impeccable case. 100% correct theology. Nobody can argue with it. Unfortunately, it didn't help my anxiety very much. And for many years after that, I would read lots of books like that, trying to figure it out. And I would feel some small encouragement, but it wouldn't be enough to make a dent in my anxiety. My life had shown me that the world could be a bit of a crazy place. And I thought that if I understood the theology of God, if I studied enough how God's sovereignty works in a crazy world, I would be able to trust Him. I would be able to grow in dealing with anxiety that way. Unfortunately, these books helped a little bit, but not quite. They didn't quite do the deal. What I discovered many years later, though, is that I was indeed growing in my ability to trust God. But it wasn't coming from correct theology alone. It was coming from experiencing God's love in prayer on a regular basis. It was coming from seeing Him answer prayers quite frequently on an almost daily basis. You see, the brain has two different tracks. There's a slow track and there's a fast track. The slow track is up here, right above your left eye. That's where logic is, right? That's where thoughts are. That's where we understand theology. And that part of the brain, where thoughts are, takes about 500 milliseconds, about half a second, for a thought to develop. And that's relatively slow. But that's not the whole brain. There's a lot more to the brain than that. There's an emotional center in the brain that's a little bit deeper, right about this level. And also, we experience a lot of emotions in the right side of the brain. The emotional center of the brain works so much faster. It works 10 times faster. It takes only 50 milliseconds for a response to happen there. So it takes 10 times, it's 10 times as fast. And that's where anxiety lives. It doesn't live up here in the slow track where I was trying to understand theology. That's why it wasn't working, right? Now, ideally, the brain is supposed to be wired so that these two areas are talking to each other. And when they do, things make sense. And, you know, we're afraid of things that make sense why we're afraid of them. But let me ask you this. How many of you have been afraid of something, have been anxious about something, and you know it's completely illogical and you shouldn't be anxious? That ever happened to any of you? Yeah, most of us have had that experience, right? Well, that's because that communication fails. It's not foolproof. So that communication from the slow part and the fast part, from the cognitive part and the anxious part, that's not foolproof, and it fails sometimes. So what I needed to experience was God's answer in the emotional part of the brain. It's called the limbic system, right? So the next question is, then obviously, how do we do that? How do we experience God in that emotional part of the brain so we can address that anxiety? And that's where asking God for daily bread comes in. The way we're going to look at that is through the science of something called attachment, because attachment lives in the fast part of the brain. Research into attachment began in the 1950s by a British doctor named John Bowlby, as well as his Canadian colleague. Her name was Mary Ainsworth. They began by studying mothers in Uganda, and they noticed that when Ugandan mothers had their little toddlers with them, they would allow the toddlers to kind of go explore in the village. And if the child got in trouble, either they got scared or they got hurt or something, they would either look over and check in on mom, make sure she was there, or they would run back to mom, you know, crying, and then she would take care of them. If they were hurt, she would give them emotional support. If they were hungry, she would feed them, etc. And as long as they experienced mom as a secure base, they called that a secure base. If they experienced mom as a secure base, they could explore further and further. And what I want to argue today, and I want to present you with, is the idea that God can become for us a secure base in prayer that then gives us the security that we need in the rest of life to go out exploring and taking whatever risks he invites us to take. So I want to look a little bit as to how this idea of a secure base develops, how this idea of attachment develops. It's almost always some combination of a child communicating a need followed by being taken care of. And as adults, it's not too different, actually. It happens both physically and emotionally. A baby may be hungry, she cries, mom feeds her and interacts with her, shows her love, provides a soothing voice, etc. The child feels that her needs are met, and she grows in attachment as a result. Another thing that happens is they start to grow in wanting to be around mom. They want to be close to mom. That's called proximity seeking, wanting to be close to the person we're attached to. For an older child on the playground, you know, it could be very similar. You know, they may fall and get hurt. They run to mom or dad crying. Mom or dad provide comfort and encouragement, and they send them back out to play. The child feels seen. They feel heard. They sense that their parents feel their pain, cares about them, and is happy to be with them. They're not like, oh, God, you know, here he goes again, right? These interactions happen over and over again, and they reinforce a healthy attachment. And the actual term for healthy attachment is secure attachment. So that's the term we're going to use, secure attachment. Secure attachment and secure base. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard of the stories of the Chronicles of Narnia. The story is about some children from London during World War II. And because of the devastating bombings during that war, there was a program to send kids out into the countryside. And in this fictional story, these children end up living with an old professor and in the countryside, and they're playing around the house, and they find this magic cupboard, and they go in the cupboard, and they have lots of adventures and so on. And the story, of course, is very fictional, but that program is not fictional at all. There really was a program to send kids away from the cities into the countryside to keep them safe from the bombings. Now, not all the kids from the cities went. And after the war, they did studies to see and compare how did the kids who stayed with their parents do compared with the kids who were sent to the countryside. And it turns out that the kids who stayed with their parents, who saw dead bodies in the streets, who had to rush to shelters every other night, those kids actually did better than the ones who were sent to the countryside. And they did better because they were with their attachment figures. My own experience is very similar. As I mentioned earlier, I grew up in Beirut. When I was 11 years old, the Lebanese Civil War began. Not long after that, my uncle was kidnapped. And for a few days, we didn't know what was going to happen to him, and thank God he was released. Then my father one day heard shelling near where my sister's school was, and so he took off running to get them from school. And on his way, he was hit by shrapnel in his thigh. Went in one side, came out the other. Twice we had to flee the fighting. The second time, we had to take a cargo ship. And this was not a big cargo ship with lots of containers. This was a much smaller deal. And it had hundreds and hundreds of refugees on board. And for 3 days, we slept on deck on our suitcases. You know, we staked out a little area probably no bigger than this rug, and we slept on it for 3 days. Our home was also looted and occupied. We ended up moving 6 or 7 times in a 3-year period. Now, I'm not going to tell you that this time was not without trauma for me. I know that it still affects me in some ways. But I do remember this. I do remember that whenever my dad was around, I felt safe. I was not scared. Whenever my dad was there, it didn't feel like a huge deal to me. In fact, I played in the parking lot behind our apartment building all the time with my friends. You know, I didn't give it a thought. My dad was there. I felt safe. I knew that he would do whatever it would take to take care of me. I also know that some of the hardest times for me was when he had to travel and not be with us during that difficult time. Now, I know that for some of you, hearing this may be difficult because you haven't had good attachment figures, you know, whether mothers or fathers. But I want to encourage you and give you hope, because attachment issues can be healed. What Bowlby and Ainsworth found is that not all parents are a good secure base for their children. Not all children form secure attachments. What they found is that some parents are really a little anxious when the kid comes to them hurt and crying, and they overreact, and the child picks that up, and they feel that anxiety. And so they grow up to have kind of an anxious attachment. Or the parent might be inconsistent, you know, showing up sometimes and not others. Now, for those of you who are parents, don't start feeling guilty on me. There is such a thing called good enough parenting. You only need to be there, they say, some of the research says you only need to be there about 30% of the time. If you do that, if you do good enough, that's kind of good enough, right? It's pretty impossible to be there all the time. But there are situations where parents don't make that 30% cut, right? And unfortunately, kids grow up with that insecure attachment. So they grow up and they're in close relationships and marriages, dating relationships and so on. They feel very insecure. You know, am I going to be rejected? Or if there's slight conflict, you know, they start to be afraid that the relationship's going to be over. And they bring that into their relationship with God. You know, they wonder at the drop of a hat, is God mad at me now? You know, and I don't know if some of you experienced some of that. You know, or they something bad happens during the day, and they take that and they put it on God. It's like, oh, it's because, you know, God is not happy with me all of a sudden. And that's not the only way that attachment can go wrong. There are other ways. Sometimes parents feel like the child is kind of faking it, that they just want attention, you know, that they're being somewhat manipulative, and so they don't give the child what they need. And so the child, to protect themselves, start to become avoidant. They start to avoid closeness. They start to avoid intimacy. And anytime, you know, as an adult then, anytime the relationship starts to feel a little close, they start talking about sports or the kids or something, you know. And then with God, in their relationship with God, they can be very hesitant to bring their feelings to God. They don't want to bring anything that feels vulnerable to God. In the worst kind of situations, the parents themselves, their own emotional state is very chaotic. You know, or even in the worst cases, abusive. And, you know, for the child, that's pretty impactful, because they grow up not really even knowing how to behave in a close and intimate relationship. They don't really know what to expect. But even if you did not have healthy attachment figures, you can find healing. It does take some work. It does take some consistent interactions. But therapists bring that healing all the time with consistent interactions. It can also happen in marriage. Sometimes it happens in marriage with coaching from a therapist. Sometimes it just happens because, you know, the situation is right. It can happen in close relationships. And it is okay for it to happen in some relationships and not others. That's a common experience. But the most important thing is that, yes, even though you may have not had the most secure attachment growing up, you can develop secure attachment with God. And how we develop secure attachment with God is a lot like how it happens with children and parents. Let's think back to how little children are with their parents. They express their needs. Their parents meet their needs, both physically and emotionally. As they repeat this over and over again, attachment develops. And it's the same with God. We regularly bring our challenges and needs to Him in prayer, and we experience His care, His comfort, His provision. And we begin to experience prayer as a secure base. And the more we experience that prayer with God as a secure base, the more we can venture out and feel a sense of security, a sense of safety. I'm not saying, of course, that this replaces therapy or that it completely heals anxiety, but in my experience, it does play a significant role. I remember the first time I noticed this, I was traveling on a business trip to Columbus, Ohio, and God had been nudging me to pray more consistently. And I felt kind of like He was telling me, if you invest a little more in prayer, it's going to help your anxiety. But my flight had arrived late. I had early morning meetings the next day, lost an hour because of the time zone change. And so I wasn't going to get a lot of sleep. But I thought I would kind of take God up on His offer, and I set my alarm clock early, and I woke up and I prayed. And for the first time, I felt the anxiety recede. And it was gone for a number of hours. I was like, oh, this kind of works, you know? And so I decided to take Him up more on that. If we go back to Bowlby, the father of attachment science, he has a great quote at the end of one of his books. I even put it in my book. He says, throughout adult life, the availability of a responsive attachment figure remains the source of a person's feeling secure. All of us, from the cradle to the grave, are happiest when life is organized as a series of excursions, long or short, from the secure base. Ah, there's the quote. It's up there. Okay. Now, I thought it would be great to rewrite this quote from God's point of view. So I decided to rewrite it as if Jesus were writing it, or as if God were writing it, right? So throughout this, how this is not boldly, this is how I think God would write it. Throughout adult life, the availability of Jesus as a responsive attachment figure remains the source of a person's feeling secure. All of us, from the cradle to the grave, are happiest when life is organized as a series of excursions, long or short, from our time spent in Jesus' loving presence in prayer. I know that when I had an insecure attachment with God, I know when I experienced Him in answering prayer here and there and not regularly, when I experienced His loving presence only once in a while, I really did not see Him as any kind of effective answer to anxiety. It was too sporadic. It was only by coming to God day after day, sharing with him my thoughts, my feelings about what was on my mind that day, just like Jesus says, ask for your daily needs that day, and sensing that He heard me and that He was with me, and asking Him for what I needed that day, seeing His answers day in and day out, only then did it start to make a difference, did it start to make an impact in my emotional brain. Now, I've thought enough about prayer to know that for many of you, not all of you, but many of you right now are starting to feel a sense of guilt or shame or failure, you know, because your prayer life hasn't been going as well as you'd like. You've had your ups and downs, and it hasn't been as consistent. So let's see if I can quiet down some of that shame and some of that guilt. I want you to put your hand on your heart. Close your eyes for a minute. Then I want you to think of a time when you felt a lot of love for someone, or when you felt most loved. Maybe you can only think of a small experience of love. That's okay. Just think of that time and multiply that a million times and know that that is how much God loves you. Just know that. That experience a million times. You can think of maybe your wedding or the time you held your first baby. Whatever it is. Can you feel that? Can you feel his love? Now let me ask you, how's the guilt and shame doing? Hopefully it's gone, right? Now this exercise is something you can do at the beginning of your prayer time as well. You know, get into love. Take some time to get into God's love. And if you get stuck later in your prayer, if things start to go off the rails, you can do the exercise again and get into love. After you do that, you can tell God about the things that matter to you in the moment. This is very important. Okay, in order to receive God's care emotionally, we have to be detailed in what we tell him. It's very tempting to think, God knows about it, I don't have to get into it. Uh-uh. Wrong. We have to speak to God as if he doesn't know any of the details. I want to say it again. Tell God your feelings as if he doesn't know any of the details. Because as you bring your hurt feelings to him, you receive his comfort, just like that kid on the playground. God knows that's how he designed our brains. And the scripture also supports this. You know, I find it interesting that the Psalms in the Bible are full of emotion. The Psalms were the prayer book that Jesus used. At the time of Jesus, Jews would pray at least 3 times a day, and they used the Psalms a lot in those 3 times a day. Many churches have continued that tradition, and those churches, in the different prayer times in the day, they use mostly Psalms, and they do the Lord's Prayer. Both are there. And the Psalms are so full of expressing those feelings to God, all the way from the very bad feelings to the very positive feelings. They're all there. And what that tells us is that our feelings, both positive and negatives, need to be put into words and those words brought to God. As we bring those daily needs before God more regularly, we'll see more answered prayer. We will grow in the sense of being cared for, provided for. We'll grow in seeing more of God's activity in our lives. One more thing that I find really interesting about attachment theory is that whole concept of proximity seeking, wanting to be with the person that we're attached to. Very often when I talk to people about prayer, and I do that a lot, right? I hear this quite often, and it's very well-meaning, but I hear it quite often. People will tell me, yeah, prayer is like going to the gym. You know, I go for it. I have to push myself. And when I do it, I feel good afterwards because, you know, I get the benefits. Whenever I hear that, it makes me cringe a little bit. I want to say, really, so if you're married to your spouse, you say to her or him, having dinner with you every day is like going to the gym. I force myself to do it, and then I feel good about it afterwards. Something's wrong here. If we have a healthy attachment to our spouse, we actually want to be with them. We look forward to dinner. It's life-giving. It's connecting. It's joyful. Now, that's not to say, of course, that we don't have bad days. That doesn't mean that we don't have a argument or a fight or where maybe we're distracted and we don't feel like talking at dinner. Maybe that goes for a day or two or three. But if it goes for a week or two or three, you know, we better pay attention. We better do something. We better talk to somebody. Maybe we talk to our small group. Maybe we talk to our pastor. Maybe we talk to our counselor. And the same thing is true about our prayer life. You know, if the time with God feels dry, for a day or two or a few days even, no big deal. We'll push through it. You know, we have a little bit of self-discipline. We can push through. But if it's a week or two or three, you know, we start to think maybe I need to do something a little differently. Maybe we try something different in prayer. Maybe we listen to a podcast, read a book, talk to our small group, talk to a pastor, talk to a spiritual director. We don't just let it go. So let's not go to guilt and shame over prayer. Let's instead go to God's loving invitation so we can be securely attached to him. I find it interesting that this is not the only place that Jesus talks about bread in the gospel. He actually says he is the bread of life. You know, in John chapter 6, he says, For the bread of God is the bread that comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. And so the people around him say, "Sir," they said, "always give us this bread." And Jesus declared, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty." And when we put these two texts in tension, Jesus first telling us to ask God for our daily bread, and then Jesus telling us he himself is the bread of life, we get an extra dimension to that prayer. You see, as we come to God for our daily bread, for our daily needs, we not only get our physical needs met, we also get spiritual food. We get the spiritual bread that gives us eternal life. We get the bread of life himself. We get to experience the life and love of Jesus himself.